Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome, everybody. We've got ourselves a podcast stream today. It's Tuesday. Welcome, everyone. I do not know where my background is. Why am I having problems with this? Don't know why my background's not showing up. I'll have to fix that the next time I'm not live. Can't really fix it at the moment. It's too confusing to figure out for me. Welcome, everybody. We're live on four different platforms today. We're live on Twitter. We're live on Speak Free Radio, Odyssey, and GTV. I just got out of a interesting Twitter space, to say the least. A little bit of complications on both sides of the political right, I guess we'll say. Actually, maybe not even political. Natsok for Jesus, welcome, brother. Gazing, we got Owie, Officer Chauvin, and maybe next time. Welcome, guys. Welcome, everybody. So I do not have a topic. Normally, I prepare my topic before I start the show, and on today, unfortunately, we had a very long Twitter space that I was a part of, so I didn't have time to prepare a topic. So I think we're gonna end up picking another Michael Sugrue video to cover. We'll most likely do part three of the Republic. Where he goes through some more of the sections of the Republic, which is a very long book. But before we get into that, let me just kind of go over my schedule this week. Not too much crazy going on. I can, that sucks, sure. It's probably not worth listening to. It mostly degenerates and devolves into ad hominems, which is very unfortunate on both sides, but it is what it is. Okay, so. Actually, let me write this down. Okay. That sounds good, Owie. Thanks for letting me know. Appreciate that. So schedule for this week. Obviously, today is the Speak Free Radio show. We're live today. Tomorrow, we're going to be live at 7 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be joined by Paul Allen. He is, I guess he would define himself as a Groiper. We're going to have a very diplomatic and fair discussion about some of the conflicts that exist between both of these groups that I personally feel exist without reason, to be entirely honest. I think there's a lot of miscommunication and misunderstanding between the two sides, but we'll definitely have a discussion about that and keep it cordial and hopefully produce something valuable out of it if we can. Okay, on Thursday, no show Thursday. Friday, we're going to be live with G-Man at 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll be having Tunitris on as our guest, as a good friend of mine, as I'm sure you guys know. Speaking of Tunitris in the Twitter, welcome, brother. Welcome. Thank you guys, by the way, for sharing the show. Do appreciate that. Saturday will be live at 8 p.m. Eastern. I gotta put that on my schedule. I have not done so yet. And Sunday is to be determined. I don't have anything set up for Sunday yet. If I can get some kind of a show going or somebody to come on, I might do a show Sunday. I just don't have anything super important yet to do that with. So I will do my best to do so in the future here. Let's see what we got. Yeah, we'll do this one. Okay, so we will be doing the final Michael Sugrue video on the Republic by Plato. This is the last one of the series that he did on that book. So that's what we're going to cover today. By the way, hello, everybody. Again, for the folks listening over on Speak Free Radio, if you guys would like to participate in a chat room and discuss, you can do so via Odyssey, Twitter, or GTV. It's at Logos Revealed on all, except for Twitter. There's just an I at the end of it. Yep, sounds good. Sounds good. If you guys will give me one moment, I'm just going to grab some tissues. I've got a little bit of a runny nose at the moment. I will be right back. I'm just going to start this video up for you guys while I do so.
Book 6 and 7 of the Republic are in some ways the high point of this dialogue. It's in Book 6 and 7 that Plato presents us with his ontological and epistemological doctrines, which have been largely assumed tacitly in the earlier part of the discussion of justice and the ideal city and the philosopher king. Book 6 extends the third wave, the wave of argument which threatens to overwhelm the Socratic city, the impossibility of the philosopher king, the impracticality of the ideal city, is one of the main concerns of Socrates, or Socrates' discussion and Plato's discussion of this new kind of ideal justice. And in Book 6, we continue the problem of the impossibility of the ideal city in this physical world. The world of space and time, Plato wants to suggest, is radically incomplete or unsatisfactory. There's something wrong with what we call everyday reality. So what he's going to drive at is that there's another reality, a second realm, a different, not a different area in the sense of space and time, but a place or a world outside of space and time entirely. And true justice, true beauty, truth itself exists in this realm outside of space and time. So Plato wants to tell us, in some ways, what the great mystics have tried to tell us, that the world of the senses is the veil of Maya. It's the veil of illusion. It's not real. It's somehow less perfect, less certain, less permanent than a second realm, the realm of mind, the realm of thought, the realm of pure ideas, which is independent of and separate from this world of space and time.
So this is the opposite of what we were listening to in the worldview of Nietzsche, right? In Nietzsche's worldview, here and now, that this earthly realm is all there is. There's nothing after. We're just going to die and rot into the ground. So it's all about having power here, doing what is best for yourself here, right? Pushing morality to a bit of the foreground or the background. Socrates is stating that everything we do here is a preparation for what's to come next, right? That there is this next realm, whether we want to view it as heaven or the heavens, or, you know, everybody has a different, all the different religions have a different explanation for what they believe this thing to be. So Socrates is laying the foreground for how he perceives it and what he believes is present there. So he essentially sums it up as a state of harmony, of harmony with the nature of the soul. Sparky, welcome, brother. I see you over in the Twitter chat. It's nice to see a couple people chatting over on Twitter. Thank you, guys. Welcome.
So Plato asks us to make a leap, and he wants the leap to be that if somehow his idealizations, his perfect cities and perfect philosophers and perfect rulers won't fit into this world of space and time, that means that there's something very seriously wrong with space and time itself, right? This world around us is not real, or not as real as the ideal realm he's going to construct. So Book 6 talks about the philosopher king and says, gives us one of the great paradoxes in Platonic philosophy, not till philosophers are kings will we have a good city. The difficulty is that no empirical city wants philosophers to run things. There's no regime that is looking for a philosopher to come in and run things. Philosophers are thought of as being corrupt and corrupting. Remember that Socrates is condemned for corrupting the youth of Athens, for teaching the wrong kinds of religious beliefs, and philosophers don't seem to be the appropriate sort of person to run a city. Most Greeks are thinking back to the Homeric hero. You want to think of a king, think of Agamemnon. There's a real king for you. But Socrates would not be any Greek's idea of a good ruler. So Socrates has to justify the idea that philosophers ought to be kings, and that, and the hard part, it, once you explain the argument, is not that people, is not persuading people to bring the philosopher into the city, but rather persuading the philosopher to take on the job of being the king. Remember, one of the funny ironies of this book is that we've established justice by making sure that there's one man, one job. Everyone pursues only one course in life, except for the best and most wise person in the city, the philosopher king. Because to be a philosopher is not the same thing as being a king. He's the only person that has two jobs. So apparently the justest man in the city, the man with the most wisdom and the most philosophical insight, is also the person who we force, due to our own necessity, to engage in a kind of injustice, to pursue more than one job. It's one of the crowning ironies of the Republic.
I also want to add... I also want to add, for those who are unfamiliar with the death of Socrates, the end of Socrates' life, he was sentenced to death by poison, drinking poison. It was a way that they did it back in the day. He was sentenced to death for corrupting the youth. And the accusation against him in corruption of the youth was that he was straying people away from God, which is obviously quite ironic, because he was doing quite the opposite. He was just straying them away from the belief in God that the power, the ruling class at the time had, right? So they were angry with him for spreading something that could be harmful to their power, right? So if let's say Socrates' ideas or worldview was to win over, and philosopher kings were put into place instead of the guys that were ruling at the time, those guys who are self-interested and greedy that were ruling at the time would obviously be kicked out. So they had, in self-defense, this was their means of self-defense, was to put Socrates to death in order that his ideas could not be preached. Yet again, something we very synonymously see happen with Adolf Hitler post-World War II, or during World War II, right? The world was sent against him because the Jewish ruling elite and their finance, they knew if Hitler's worldview was to prevail, people would no longer recognize the Jewish financial system, and Jews would no longer be able to be a parasite among nations. So it's a very interesting thing to draw between the two. But there is quite a comparison there in morality, or the use of power against somebody who's doing something correct.
Well, in defending the philosopher, Socrates also argues that the real corrupter of the people, the real corrupter of youth, is Athens itself. In other words, the philosopher is the one who saves and reclaims and improves the people that listen to him. The city is what causes these corruptions, brings in these innovations, generates all kinds of skepticism and immorality. The sophists just work for the demos of the city. They're just employees. If the sophists, these tyrannical men with great souls, had been given a good education, they would be potential philosopher kings. In other words, the similarity of soul between Socrates and Thrasymachus, there's a similarity in the depth or the profundity of their souls. The difference really amounts to the fact that Socrates, by divine dispensation, or maybe the daimon or something, has gotten these philosophical insights, has gotten a philosophical education, I guess a self-education. Whereas Thrasymachus, because he has been denied these insights, with his great soul, goes to the greatest of extremes. What is it in Paradise Lost, where Satan is one of the greatest of angels and then falls, and when the greatest fall, they fall all the way. So that's true of all the sophists. They are great souls with bad educations. And not only bad educations, but they pander to the city. In an oligarchic city, they pander to the oligarchy. In a democratic city, they pander to the people. But in every case, they are just employees. The real corruption doesn't come from sophists or philosophers. The real corruption comes from the people themselves in every city. Ignorance is the source of all corruption and evil.
It's a really good line, right? And we experience this exact same thing with our system today, our government, right, or the Nimrods that are running said government. They're pandering to whatever is going to get them the best situation for themselves, the best way of life, the simplest way of life. We see this with both the right and the left-wing parties, again, going to things like AIPAC, begging for lobbying dollars. They're pandering. They pander to Israel, recognizing that that's where the most source of money will come from in order for them to actually get somewhere in the political campaign, right? Pure Nomad, welcome, brother. Welcome. Saxon, that one's going over my head, brother. I don't know what you're talking about. Asclepios? I'm not familiar. I'm not familiar with that reference. So again, a major issue we have in today's society. And then furthermore, as he says here, the mass, the ignorance of the mass is what creates corruption. Well, the problem here is that it's hard to blame the mass when the mass is being directly manipulated and corrupted in their own right, right? So you almost have to be above the mass in order to be able to pull yourself out of that corruption, out of that ignorance, right? No one is just handing you these like intellectual works and these philosophical works and telling you how to live the appropriate life. Even our churches today aren't really providing the means to understanding on a higher level how to live a good life and not be a corrupted individual. So unless you are a very ambitious individual, how is one in modern society to remain from corruption, to be able to push for things better for themselves? It's very rare, right? It's hard to come across. Ah, I see, Saxon. I don't know if that was a true statement. I think that was put in there symbolically, personally. You got me there. I did not remember that. It's been a while, I guess. All right, let's continue.
Now, if we're going to have a philosopher king, we have to figure out how to educate a philosopher king, what he'll have to know, and how he'll be different from the defenders, the silver people in society. And what we're going to do is have to figure out what it is that the philosopher king knows that everybody else doesn't know. And what he knows, it turns out, is the form of the good. The form of the good is the true, changeless, atemporal, aspatial goodness in which all other good things in the world somehow participate. And what Plato gives us at the end of Book 6 is something called the divided line, which is an ontological and epistemological doctrine which tries to explain the kind of universe or the different kinds of things that the universe contains in Plato's view. Okay? So we're going to have to, there are four basic divisions in it. We'll start at the bottom of it. The bottom, the least real things, are things like shadows. When I put my hand up and it catches these lights, there's a shadow cast on the back wall. Well, the shadow is very different from my hand. And the shadow is somehow less real than my hand? Well, Plato thinks that the least real things are what we might call images. And this realm, this bottom, least real set of things include images like shadows. Also, if you hold up a mirror to someone, the image of your face in the mirror is somehow less than your face itself. So that's a kind of an image. But there are other kinds of images too, and this is quite worthy of note. Poetry and painting and sculpture are all the creation of images. This is very important. It helps explain why it is that Plato places the poets well down on the scale of knowledge and reality. Poetry.
It's a very, very important thing, by the way. Krieger, welcome, brother, welcome. You'll hear this in the Republic, and at first this might sound odd or really off-putting when Plato states that he is against poets. He's against poetry being a part of society. And if there is to be poetry, it's going to have to be heavily monitored so that it's not doing corrupt or immoral things or creating bad representations of real things. This is really interesting and important because if we were to follow this line of thought that Socrates and Plato lays out via Plato in this work, our society today would be in a better spot, right? So what if our founding fathers, or not our founding fathers, but our system, our statesmen, at the time when Jews came and decided to create the concept of Hollywood, right? What if our leaders said, you know, this is something that could easily corrupt the youth. We're gonna put some chains on this and make sure this doesn't get out of control. They didn't. They didn't put any kind of barriers on it or laws across it. They did try a little bit late in the game, so to speak, with this, I think it was HCAC or something, House Committee Against Un-American Activities, something like that, HCAA, that when they were trying to weed out communist infiltration in the movie theaters, right, or in the movies, the biggest problem is they didn't point it out as Jewish infiltration. If they would have pointed it out as such, it would have been easier to recognize. They were viewing it specifically in the political lens. But they tried a little bit, but at that point it was too late. Hollywood, there was so much money and so much power through that that they were able to continue their game, right? Yeah, very, very well correct, said, maybe next time. So again, a lot of people like poetry, so they might be against this. But for the most part, it's very important that we recognize why they were saying that, because the same way we view Hollywood today as a very degenerative force that is corrupting the minds of our people, all the way back then, at that time, they viewed poetry to be that corruptive force that was doing that to their people, right? And rightfully so. It's the exact same system there, right? That was their media at the time. That was their entertainment industry.
In the extended sense of constructing a representation, right, and which would include sculpture and painting and music, for example, poetry is an image in the same way that a shadow or your reflection of a pool of water is an image. And these things are even less real than the objects of sense perception around us. So at the very bottom of the divided line, the very bottom in the realm of being, we have images, which includes all of the arts plus things like shadows and mirror images. What we do when we cogitate, when we mentally arrest and absorb and envelop these images, is Plato calls imagination. In other words, and to imagine is a very specific and definite mental activity, an activity of the soul in which we apprehend. When we listen to poems by Homer, we imagine Hector and Achilles fighting it out. When we look at a painting, we imagine the scene represented by the painting, but in fact it's just a set of pigments on a piece of paper or on a piece of canvas. Right? So we do a definite mental activity. There's a definite state of the soul which corresponds to this particular kind of thing and to the other three different kinds of thing. Now, one up on the divided line, above images like shadows and poems, we have objects of sense perception. Now, here's a funny thing about sense perception. Plato doesn't think it's reliable. And maybe if you lived in 400 BC, you would find sense perception unreliable as well. Remember that he doesn't have modern natural science and the technological and logical triumphs of modern natural science to make him feel comfortable with the world of the senses. He lives in a world where we don't have an accurate or adequate or satisfactory theory of the world of space and time, and for that reason he thinks it's uncertain. For example, imagine for the ancient Greeks what the problem of the mirage must have been like. You know what a mirage is? When you are in the desert and you see in the distance a lake of water, and then you walk to that lake of water, and there's nothing there. Now Plato is going to ask you, if he happens to be around, where'd it go? And if you don't have anything intelligent to say, he's going to ask you, well, why do you feel comfortable then with basing your understanding of the world on your sense perceptions, which are often illusory, often mistaken? Right? Think about mirages. Think about putting a pencil in a glass of water and the idea of refraction by water, so the pencil looks bent and then when you take it out it turns out to be straight. We don't have any way of accounting for that. Plato thinks that there are a whole bunch of examples of sense perception that are just unreliable. Now, if you will...
It's a very good point, right? That was actually a perfect analogy drawn. How many cartoons or movies or TV shows have you seen where they use this exact same illusion, where you know two guys are walking in the desert and they haven't drank in days, so they're going through this heat stroke and they're becoming delusional, and out in the distance they think they see this this body of water and this pure land, and then they get there and it's gone, right? So the senses can be illusory. Midwestern Warrior, welcome, brother. Welcome. It's nice to have you.
Willing to accept the idea that some sense perceptions are unreliable. Well, I feel pretty certain about this podium in front of me, but how do I know it's not going to behave like that very odd body of water in the desert? In other words, the next time I wrap my knuckles on it, how do I know it's still going to be there? Plato thinks you really can't, and in fact, there is no logical way of being certain that the podium is still going to be there next time, and it's still going to have the properties of that it had the first time I touched it. So Plato is going to argue, and it's particularly plausible because of the state of Greek science, that sense perceptions are not a satisfactory basis for a theory of knowledge. So what he's going to say is that the whole realm of the senses are subject to change, subject to, they come into being and they go out of being, and you really can't know the objects of sense perception in the same way, and for pretty much the same reason, you really can't know poetic images or shadows. They're not real enough to have real knowledge. The best you're going to have of these objects of sense perception is beliefs. And some of them may be handy. In other words, I recommend that when you walk out the door, that you open the door first, right? Because it's made of wood and you're going to hurt yourself. But that's, in Plato's sense, that's just a belief. Who knows? Maybe this will be the funny door that you can walk right through. I mean, we saw what happened in the desert with the lake, right? It was there and then it disappeared. Maybe when we walk up to the threshold of the door, maybe the door will disappear too. You can't be sure that it won't. And that's Plato's ace in the hole. You can't really be sure.
Bigot Smalls with a $5 investment, guys. Can we get the Romans in the chat for Bigot Smalls? He says, wow, fuck. Welcome. Thank you, brother. Thank you. Get those Romans up for Bigot Smalls. Gazing says, not believing your senses is a dangerous predicament. It's not saying to not believe your senses. What it's saying is your senses are based in belief, right? It's saying, so I believe that this is a mug in my hands because I feel it, and it feels like a mug, and it looks like a mug, so I believe it's a mug, right? But your senses don't have reasoning behind them. All they have is belief, right? I'll give you an example. I believe someone might believe that they go to heaven when they die. Do you have reason behind that? Do you have proof for this? Can you put out on paper and express to us how that's possible? Can you reason with us to show us that logically? Or is it a belief? So what he's saying is poems, art, things like this, these are representations of reality, okay? Senses, things that are a little more illusory in this sense, these are beliefs of what reality is, so it's not knowledge yet, right? You can't call vision knowledge, right? To see something doesn't mean that you're knowledgeable of it, right? I can see this cup, right? But that doesn't mean because I see it that I'm knowledgeable of what the properties of it are. It could be ceramic, it could not be, right? I'm not sure, because I'm only just giving it an eye's gaze, right? And this goes for many things. A cup is a bad example, but there's many more examples where you can look at something, and just by looking at it, you might not be able to tell right away, right, what exactly that is. Sometimes you can. Sometimes you can tell what something's made of, right? You can look at a mailbox and say, oh, that one's made out of metal, or that one's made out of aluminum. You might be able to do that, but not always, right? So these are specifically based in the field of belief. So you have a four-pronged system here that he's going to go through. Okay, so there's representations of reality, right, which is the most illusory and the least grounded in reality. Then there are beliefs of what reality is, where you have no way of actually logically or reasonably explaining that to somebody, but it exists in your belief system. Next, he's going to go into pure knowledge now, or not pure knowledge, he's going to go into knowledge, things that are actually can be provenly understood.
So he's going to say, look, I'm looking for absolute certainty. There's another thing to emphasize when you read Plato. Plato doesn't want to be almost right. He came to play. He wants absolute certainty that's logically demonstrable, and he wants to take no nonsense about it. And since the realm of the senses just doesn't offer us any absolute certainty, then it's not going to be satisfactory to Plato. Now, hearken back to the end of my last lecture. When I said that this realm of space and time, it seems like there's a gap between theory and practice, and his perfect city and his philosopher king can't exist down here. Well, Plato thinks that just shows you how inferior this world of space and time is. In other words, his theory is right, and if the world won't accommodate it, then the world is wrong, which is a deeply crazy thought. I mean, if you think about it long enough, it becomes kind of funny. I mean, although Plato is sublime and beautiful and profound, I mean, that opens the door in some ways to all kinds of crazy stuff. The world is wrong. Well, there are a lot of people, you know, who have been locked up on account of that. Plato, on the other hand, offers us an alternative way of interpreting our everyday sense experience. He says, look, don't place too much value on that. That's mere body. Think about soul. Think about mind. Think about pure logic. When we move up the divided line, now those first two categories, the realm of shadows, the realm of images, and the next realm, which is the realm of sense perception, you know, objects, tables and chairs, things like that. Plato wants to take both of those together and say those two categories of thing, you can have some opinions about those things, but you really can't know them. So in other words, representations and sense perceptions are not objects of knowledge. Now this is going to help him out. That means that no wonder you can't really know this external world. The things that you can really know are outside of space and time altogether. And here's where Plato plays his ace in the hole, mathematics. Mathematics is God's gift to Platonists. Whenever you argue with a Platonist, if the Platonist knows of his business, he's going to start talking to you about arithmetic. Because you can't weasel out when you start talking about arithmetic. You can't get all relativistic and say, well, you believe this, I believe that. He's just going to bring you right back to the number line. He's not going to take any nonsense from you. When Plato has to go to his strong suit, he always goes to a mathematical example. When you are reading the dialogues, if you see Plato start to talk about arithmetic or about geometry or about some other mathematical entity, underline that section, because Plato is going for the kill. When he wants to win an argument, he goes with math and then goes for the pin. So when we move up out of the realm of space and time, Plato wants us to believe that the next thing up, the category that moves us from a mere opinion to real knowledge, is mathematics. Mathematics is real knowledge. Triangles, numbers like 7 and 3, various kinds of mathematical relationships like parallel and intersection can be defined in every and only ways, in exactly the way that Plato wants things defined. Because you've got to remember, he's derived his conception of a real definition, of a satisfactory definition, from mathematics. If you want to define a triangle, you specify some quality that every triangle has and only triangles have. And then once Socrates realizes that he likes this kind of mathematical reasoning because it's true and permanent and unchanging, well, then he tries to force everything into the mathematical mold. If you want to talk about virtue, then he says, well, define it the way you define a triangle. If you want to define justice, well, let's say, what does every justice have, every instantiation of it, and only instantiations of justice have? So he wants to define it the way he does math. Mathematics is God's gift to Platonists. So the next step up, when we move from opinion to knowledge on the divided line, we move to mathematical objects like triangles, squares, sevens, that don't change and that are susceptible to precise, demonstrable logical analysis. And you can really think about these things. You don't just have opinions about triangles. If you think about something like the theorem of Pythagoras, that's the way right triangles are. And next year, when we bring 10th graders into a geometry class, we're going to teach them that. And if some 10th grader puts up his hand and says, no, I don't think it works this way, we're going to say, well, look, you don't understand what we mean by a triangle. You don't understand what we mean by a right angle. You don't understand what we mean by a hypotenuse. Somewhere along the line, you don't understand something, because the theorem of Pythagoras, once proven, is that's just the way right triangles are. That's the kind of knowledge Plato wants. In other words, once we get it, it's a permanent possession forever. Plato wants to stop all change, all flux, all becoming. Our knowledge must be fixed and permanent, godlike and divine, not merely human. Mathematics is the bridge that allows us to move from the realm of space and time to the realm of the forms. This realm of the forms, this area up outside of space and time, is the container of the permanent, true, real objects of knowledge.
So again, he discussed math as logic or knowledge, right? Meaning this is something that's certain. It's unchanging. It's not based upon opinion. It's not based upon interpretation. It is factual and unchanging. Now he gets into the further realm, the metaphysical realm. He'll go beyond reality and knowledge and now start expressing pure knowledge or true knowledge in its realest sense, like undiluted knowledge, right? Knowledge that's not just being seen through the human lens of understanding, but purest form knowledge, where it's not interpreted by man first, right? That's how we so knowledge is only things that we interpret as unchanging and factual. Now what he states, and this where it gets a little bit confusing, is that real knowledge is unanalyzed and untouched by man in any way, shape, or form. So it has no opinion towards it. It has no logical basis towards it. It is true, undiluted or untouched, undevolved knowledge.
And mathematical objects are the most immediately accessible, most immediately comprehensible kinds of entity that are outside of space and time. Think about, and there's some truth to this, or at least you can understand how you might come up with an idea like this. Think about the square root of -1. We can make logical statements about that. For example, the square root of -1 equals the square root of -1. That's a mathematical fact. But there's no instantiation of that in the world. There is no square root of -1. There's no quantity that corresponds to that in the physical world. Plato says, so what? That shows you what's wrong with the physical world. It doesn't correspond to these perfect mathematical ideas. Well, he says, let's go with the perfection. Let's go with being instead of becoming. Let's go with true reality. So Plato is trying to ground all of reasoning on the distrust of sense perception and the trust or belief in mathematical logical analysis. All right? Now, from mathematics, the next step up, and this is why everyone that gets a Platonic education has to know quite a bit of math. Over the academy, at the gate it said, let no one enter who has not studied geometry. If you want to go and study Platonic philosophy, you have to know your geometry, because that's the big paradigm of knowledge. Well, the next thing up, and the final stage, once we move into the realm of knowledge and being altogether, is the realm of the forms. The final, the most real thing, the most completely permanent things are the forms. And form is sometimes translated as idea, eidos, and what it means is some image, some entity in which all of the examples of that quality in this world correspond or participate. Let me give you an example. This is a book, or it's a book of Plato. There are other books on the table in front of me. The reason why we call this a book, and that a book, and that a book, even though they don't perfectly correspond, they take up different points in space, they have different covers, they have different qualities in many respects. The reason why we use the term book for all of these things is that this book and that book and the other book all participate in the form of bookness up in the realm of the forms. That allows us to account for why we call this a book and that a book and the other thing a book. All of you are sitting on chairs. These chairs differ slightly. The reason why we can call each of these different things chairs is because they all participate in the big form of chairness up in the realm of the forms. In other words, Plato thinks that the realm of the forms helps account for the fact that language brings together, under certain common terms, a completely heterogeneous set of sense perceptions. Right? Why is the First World War and the Second World War and the Civil War and the Peloponnesian War all called wars? What the hell do they have in common? There are different parts of the world. One gets fought with a sword, the other gets fought with an atomic bomb. Why do we call them all wars? Well, Plato thinks because they all participate in the form of wornness. In other words, you take some abstract quality like squares. Let's take that as an example. Now, when your geometry teacher draws a square on the blackboard, here's an important fact. It's not really a square. He says that let's consider this as a square, but if you were to actually look with a microscope at that chalk on that blackboard, what you find is that it's kind of roughly straight, but it's really not a straight line. Space and time doesn't have straight lines in it. To be a square, it has to have straight lines. Also, not perfect 90-degree angles on all sides. So this is a reminder, this image that he draws on the blackboard, this is a reminder here in the realm of space and time of the true square, which is up in heaven or up outside of space and time altogether. Right? When your geometry teacher draws a circle on the blackboard, it's never a perfect circle. The world down here doesn't have any perfect circles. That's what's wrong with the world down here. Whereas Plato's realm of the forms has a form of circleness, of the circular. And all the circles that we talk about, say, on our geometry homework, or your children's geometry homework, or your grandchildren's geometry homework, or anybody's geometry homework ever since geometry got invented, well, all of these gesture at this final form. If they didn't, they would be all unintelligible to us. Also, think about the fact that geometry doesn't change. Next year's 10th graders, when they get taught geometry, are all going to learn exactly the same stuff. How do we account for this unusual stability of this kind of knowledge? Because there's a form of the triangle, and a form of the seven, and a form of the right angle, which stays the same. We just replicate that by gesturing at the idea. Right? Well,
so the form is the highest, again, the undiluted highest value of something. So to use his analogy of shapes, right? A shape, so no, Krieger, no, specifically not in the minds of men. Let me answer this. Krieger asked, where does the realm of forms exist? In the minds of men? No, it's specifically not in the minds of men. So the realms of the forms are outside of man's perception. They're outside of man's understanding. This is what would be defined in Socrates' worldview as heaven or the metaphysical realm, right? Okay, so he views this, all of these forms, they're not physical things. You can't touch it, you can't feel it, you can't look at it, right? The senses can't sense it, right? Otherwise, it would be then considered belief, okay? It's something, it is the truest sense of something, okay? And what you are emulating, what you are trying to point at, what you're trying to do is show that as best you can, or mimic that as best you can in our reality, in the reality that we live amongst. Another dimension is a fair wording of it. I guess that would be a fair word, right? V supremacist, that's a really good question. He says, Zach, what is the main goal of your talks? Aryan leadership in America. Copy. Are Plato and Nietzsche stepping stones to make more competent leaders? Yes, absolutely. Certainly so. Again, if we study the likes of Plato, if we study the likes of Nietzsche, Cicero, all of these men we talk about, the greatest men of our history, they're educators, they're teachers. They teach us about stoicism. They teach us how to behave. They teach us how to look for the truth. They teach us how to be better men, in essence, right? So through all of that, through studying this and maybe hopefully emulating, okay, let's do this. Let's call the minds of people like Cicero and Socrates, they, now that they're gone and their knowledge exists, that knowledge can be considered the form, right? Philosophy is the form, okay? And right underneath that form, what we're trying to emulate is as close to that greatest, truest, best form of philosophy that is possible, right? That's how we reestablish a good nation, a good country, a healthy people through those activities. So yes, to an extent, they are stepping stones. Everything you learn is a stepping stone. Just reading about the Holocaust and learning that this is nonsensical and way blown out of proportion, and by definition is not a Holocaust, right? So again, a Holocaust by definition is a burnt offering of somebody, right? There was no gas chambers. It's provable that gas chambers did not exist. It's less provable that they existed, right? So therefore, on a factual basis, it was not a Holocaust. Sure, there were deaths. There were mass deaths. That is an unfortunate event, but it was not a Holocaust, right? You could even go as far to state that there were some murders. You could say that there was acts of extermination to some extent, right? You could even argue that, although I wouldn't state that far. Again, you know, is it exterminating to kill somebody who is treasonous, right? When you execute a treasonous actor against your nation, is that extermination? I don't know if we could classify it as such, but you could start to make that argument. There is no argument for Holocaust. The term, the word, the understanding, there is no argument for that. It does not, there is no argument for it. So by learning that alone, that now formulates your worldview and gives you a better understanding as to how to move forward, right? So the next time when you're in an argument with a Jew, and you say, you know, well, look, I really don't believe this nonsense that you're peddling to me. And they go, oh, but what about the Holocaust, right? What's a really good example? Mayorkas, when they put him on the political stage here, and they're like, hey, man, you know, your immigration policy is fucking terrible. It's destroying our country. And he goes, well, as the son of Holocaust survivors, I don't think you understand how awful that sounds to me, right? So if you just know that the Holocaust was bullshit, you're not impeded by his emotional behaviors and his, like, slights to try to break down your logic, right? This is how the Jew fights. They break down that essence of logic. So the larger you can understand these forms and this true knowledge, the less capable you are of being subverted or diverted away from a true worldview, right? So everything absolutely is a step in that direction. Yes, Channel 7. Well, so you're asking for the explanation, right? We don't have the explanation. That's the thing here. So humans only have mimicry or a way of emulating. They don't have a way of explaining. We can create our own ways of explaining. So for example, To go off of your point about a broken window, we could say, oh, here's a dilapidated house. How did that happen? Was it an earthquake? Was it a tornado? Right? We can look at evidence, right, and then deduce and come to a conclusion as to what we think it is, but that doesn't make that that isn't knowledge. That's how am I? This is where we're getting so nuanced with this. What we're describing here is actions, right? We're not describing items. So Socrates is purely describing items, right? A triangle is not an action, your desk is not an action. So we're not questioning how was this desk created, right? Socrates never questions this. It's why are we perceiving this as a desk? Why are we calling this a desk? Why do we view this as a desk? When I touch this, do I really know that it's a desk, right? Do I understand that this is a desk? So we're not looking at actions or movements. We're looking at objects and things. We're analyzing such things. We're not looking at verbs. We're looking at nouns. I guess it's a really simple way of putting it. You're wording it differently, sure. Seven. So again, he words it as knowledge. You're wording it as explanation. So to come to what we describe a triangle as, right, or what we describe a scientific fact as, Socrates describes that as knowledge. You can describe that as an explanation, sure. Explanation is a worse word to use because explanation can be interpreted in more than one way. So he uses knowledge as his terminology for what that is, why that is the way that is, right? I want to veer away from the word explain because that complicates this subject. We're not talking about explanations at all. So if we use the term knowledge, you're talking about the same thing, but you're wording it differently. And the wording, again, language, as he just described here, language is how we group things into a category together. So if we group it as an explanation, then I can go, oh, well, there's a heaven afterwards, right? That's my belief, but here's my explanation as to why. Well, it's not logical, it's not factual or grounded in anything, but it's an explanation, right? So it's not an appropriate term to use explanation because it can be interpreted so differently in a certain circumstance, right? I can explain to you why I think that Michael Sugru is the most intelligent man in the world, right? But now this is an opinion. So I can't prove it to you. I can explain to you and provide as much evidence as I would like, but there is no unequivocal proof of that, right? Because it can be interpreted in many ways. V Supremacist, thank you very kindly for that explanation or reasoning behind your question. Yeah, absolutely. You'll find if you watch enough of my show, nothing I do is meaningless. We're always trying to gain something. So typically Tuesdays go into philosophy chats that are trying to bring this knowledge or bring these things to people. We talk about many other things. We've covered historical events, false flags, culture, you name it. A lot of it is an education process, but yeah, there is definitely a lot of things we have to do in the future to formulate these things and bring them into reality, bring them into fruition, certainly.
Plato thinks that it goes beyond mathematics. Not only is there a realm of the square, a realm of the seven, a realm of the triangle, he also thinks that there's a form of justice, a form of truth, a form of beauty. So when we go to an art museum and we look at a painting by Salvador Dali, and we look at a painting by Rembrandt, two paintings that have nothing in common except that they are paintings and they participate in the form of paintingness. Suppose we were to say about both of those paintings, those are both truly beautiful, an entirely possible reaction. Well, what do we mean by the Rembrandt portrait and some very bizarre construction by Salvador Dali? What do we mean when we say both of them are beautiful? What Plato thinks is that they both participate in some form of ultimate beauty, which is outside the realm of space and time. And that's how different kinds of things can be described as beautiful and have that be meaningful. It's like different size squares or different squares, one drawn on a piece of paper, the other drawn on a blackboard, both participating in the form of squareness. This is Plato's ontology, which perfectly overlaps his epistemology. In other words, philosophers only construct ontological positions. An ontology just means the logos of being. It's the kind of the stratifications and different types of being. Well, once you go to the trouble of stratifying the different sorts of beings, you might as well construct various kinds of mental processes to get you in touch with those different kinds of things. So the ontology and the epistemology perfectly overlap. For the two least real kinds of things, images and objects of sense perception, you really can't know about that. All you get is opinion. For the most real kinds of things, mathematical objects and the forms, you get real knowledge. You perform mathematical deduction to find out the things in the objects of mathematical knowledge. And if you want to find out about the realm of the forms, you engage in the dialectic. This is crucial because this is what the philosopher king is going to do. The philosopher king is going to engage in the dialectic, which sounds like a very mysterious thing to do. The dialectic. It sounds like you should get a capital D, doesn't it? It's a very special kind of thing. No, it's not. The dialectic is just a very rigorous kind of conversation. In other words, you talk about it. And you talk about it seriously, and you talk about it step by step, and you honestly, with another person, try and figure out what's going on. So the dialectic, while it sounds terribly mysterious, is just the philosopher king and his philosopher pals and the other people that are involved in this, in the running of this society, talking about the best way to do things. And they try and move, and to some extent they do move, up from this mere realm of flux and change and becoming to the realm of real knowledge. And this is
so this is really important, and I'll tie this in with a supremacist, what you were asking about, you know, how are these things beneficial for us on a day-to-day? Understanding the concept of dialectic, understanding how it functions and how it works. Actually, this will go in with what Krieger and Gazing are saying as well. Understanding how these things work, you can outmaneuver somebody whose worldview is flawed or lacking in some categories simply by using dialectic, right? So questioning them, then they give a response. Then you question further, they give a response, you question further. So a really good example of this, for those who have not read it, is the first Alcibiades by Socrates, in which he aims to prove to the man he's speaking to, Alcibiades, he aims to prove to him that the only time a man is perplexed, the only time, is when he thinks he knows something that he does not know, okay? That's the only time ever that a man will feel perplexed or become perplexed, okay? I'm going to give you a really good example of this that I've experienced in my personal life. I know for a fact that the Holocaust is not true. I've gone to my family members who have been indoctrinated with emotional propaganda to tell them that it is true, and their emotions are tied to that now. So when I had a conversation with my grandfather in the form of a child, this was about a year ago. I sat down, I talked to him about this, I started laying out some facts. In the form of a child, he sat in a chair and started stomping his feet like this and yelling, "That's just not true. That's just not true." Why would you get angry about that? If it is not true, what I'm saying is not true, right? Why would you be angry about that? Instead, your brain, if it was not true, your brain would instantly say, "It is not true, and here is why." But if you don't know why, right? And if you just merely think that it's true, you're going to get angry at what I'm saying because it creates this cognitive dissonance. This emotion starts to spew out of you because it's not what you believe. It's not what you've been told, right? So again, this is why we want to get out of that realm of belief and opinion and go into the realm of truth and knowledge, right? And bring people that are in that belief and opinion realm into the realm of truth and knowledge to get them away from what's going on. So view it like this. You have the divide of... There's a dividing line here, okay? And we got truth and knowledge on the top line where we want everybody to be, and we have belief and opinion down here where a lot of people are today, okay? And the Jew is pulling people downwards. The Jew is going like this. He's just all his media, all of his propaganda, all of their behaviors, their narratives, they're pulling our people down underneath that line as best they can, keeping them in the realm of emotional belief and opinion, okay? And we, on the other hand, to try to enlighten our people, we're pulling them upwards. We're doing our best to pull them into the realms of knowledge and truth and get them to understand these things on a real, logical, factual level, right? So we're trying to, that's a process of education, right? That's the best way I can describe that. Yes, Bigot Smalls, he says, you can't dialectic with the emotional. It's very well said, right? And that's why it's very key to point out to people when they are becoming emotional, when they are being like that, you can work them into this direction. Yes, absolutely. Well said, Krieger. He says, I think this outlines the thrust of that book about stoicism that we talked about before, staying away from emotional thought. Exactly. It's the most important thing that we can do, right? No men in history, not one single man in all of history that is highly revered was an emotional man. Jesus Christ was not emotional, right? Alexander the Great was not driven by emotion. Adolf Hitler was not driven by emotion. They were logical people who used emotion only to appeal to the emotional, unthinking mass, right? That mass that views things in that emotional and opinionated realm. Channel 7, yes. Yeah, so what you're expressing is anger, right? Or frustration. The definition of perplexed is not the same as again, this is why it's really important to use words. Language is the most important thing, because it's how we collectively understand concepts. So to be perplexed is to be confused, bewildered, right? Now, that confusion can sometimes spawn anger. That confusion can sometimes spawn sadness. That confusion, more times than not, confusion will spawn anger, right? So that's why we're equating it to anger, or you are. But perplexity is simply confusion, right? I'm bewildered. I'm flustered, right? And for most people, when they get flustered, it starts to create that cognitive dissonance, and that evokes an emotional reaction. That evokes this anger, right? Yeah, Saxon, very well said. Cognitive dissonance, as well as the time and indoctrination that's been spent on these people, it's almost a futile endeavor to try to wake these people up. Still, we are mandated by our blood to climb that hill. Absolutely. Again, I just want to give you an example here. Jesus Christ, 2,000 or however many years ago here, working on 2100, but Jesus Christ, all the way back in Rome, when he saw the Pharisees acting afoul, teaching the people bad things, giving them poor education, living in corruption and vice. He saw all of these things happening. He could have said, this is a fruitless endeavor. These people are lost. They're gone. They're just gone, right? They're just lost. Instead, he created Christianity, right? And he gave these people moral doctrine. He gave these people all these different things. He laid all this stuff out, and he fought very hard to try to bring people something else, right? Again, I like to use these two examples because these are two extremes. Adolf Hitler did the exact same thing. When Weimar Germany was happening, he could have went, oh my God, these people are so far gone. There's trannies in the theaters. These people are having sex with children openly in brothels. It's done. It's over. I'm just going to go sit in my house all day and read books and ignore it, right? He very easily could have done that. He certainly could have, right? But why we are inspired by him is because he did not do that. Right, he took that fight. He picked up that fight. He picked up the torch and said, "I'm going to continue further. I'm going to do my best to enlighten these people, uplift them out of their sorrows, and help them as best I can." Right, and it worked. He did it. By the way, that's the key here. Physically in real time, we watched it work. Right, you can go look at the videos. You can study the history. It worked. He did it. Right. So, the key is, he was able to understand both realms, both the logical and the emotional. He was able to appeal to both. George Lincoln Rockwell, we've talked about this before, but George Lincoln Rockwell lays this out really well as well. In one of his speeches, he states, "One of the biggest mistakes of the conservative or the Republican Party in the United States of America, or even the National Socialist Party when they were present in the United States of America, was simply that they were always appealing to the logical side of the people. They were always trying to lay out the facts, explain things to them factually, right? Much like I do. You cannot win by just explaining the facts. not everybody will be drawn to facts. A very slim portion of the population gives a rat's ass about facts. The greater part of the population is emotionally driven towards things. Look at why most people vote for Donald Trump today, right? Are they voting because they factually think he's the greatest man that exists? Or are they voting because they are emotionally enthralled by his speeches, his behaviors, his ability to convince them of his goodwill, right? So he's appealing to the emotion. He's arousing the passions of the peoples. So if Donald Trump just stood on the stage and logically went, ladies and gentlemen, we have a swamp in this country, and that swamp is a corrupt atmosphere of disgusting plutocrats that only care about themselves and are not looking at the people at all. We have to help them. We have to try to lift these people up. In essence, we need to stop what's happening today, right? It doesn't work. So when Donald Trump comes out and he's these people in D.C. are going to suffer. I am going to stop it, right? It's this way of arousing the passions of the people. He's getting the people excited. Even if the shit he's saying is completely empty words, empty phrases, nonsensical, it's working because the passion that's behind it. It gives the people a way to go, wow, he truly believes that. Even if he doesn't believe it. Even if he doesn't. It appears as if he does believe it. Again, just one moment. I'm gonna play something really quick here that I think is important to understand this. See if I can find it. I'm going to give you this as the example here, okay? So this is a speech when Hitler was first running for chancellorship in Germany. This is a speech that he did in Germany. And I want you to pay attention to the passion that he uses. So even if you were somebody who might not be fully resonating with the things he says, when you see that passion driving out of him, it's convincing. It makes you instantly feel, wow, he really means this. Which he did. He absolutely did really mean it, right? But And the things he was saying were much more articulate and more meaningful than when we get from, you know, even characters like Trump today. So it's the passion that's being driven into this. Just pay close attention to how passionate he is.
Und rede nicht von symbolischen Handlungen, sondern schließt Frieden. Das ist der Wunsch der Völker. Wenn dieser Sonntag mir dann dieses große Vertrauen des deutschen Volkes ausspricht und mich damit erneut zum Sprecher der Nation legitimiert und mich damit berechtigt zu sagen, das, was ich jetzt hier erkläre, das erklärt Deutschland, das erklärt das deutsche Volk. Wir sind doch wieder ein so anständiges Volk geworden. Wir sind doch jetzt wieder ein so fleißiges und tatkräftiges Volk geworden. Was schaffen wir jetzt nicht wieder in Deutschland? Was haben wir nicht für Aufgaben? Man hat uns die ganzen Jahre schon eingeredet, dass der Deutsche sowieso nicht ganz gleichwürdig sei den anderen Völkern in der Welt. Was haben wir heute für Aufgaben? Was für gewaltige Werke bauen wir? Wir bauen heute die schönsten Straßen, gewaltige Anlagen, industrielle Art, neue Erfindungen haben wir gemacht, ungeheure Wohnhauskolonien, sie werden entstehen und sind bereits entstanden. Was wird nicht überall gearbeitet, auf allen Gebieten? Wir haben bewiesen in diesen 3 Jahren, dass wir ein Volk sind, das bestehen kann vor den anderen. Und darum bitte ich dich nun, deutsches Volk, darüber gib nun dein Urteil ab. Der Welt unterstelle ich mich nicht. Die kann mich nicht richten. Dir unterwerfe mich. Richte du mich. Gib du ein Bekenntnis ab, ob du meine Arbeit für richtig hältst. Ob du glaubst, dass ich fleißig gewesen bin, dass ich gearbeitet habe, dass ich mich in diesen Jahren für dich eingesetzt habe, dass ich anständig meine Zeit verwendet habe im Dienste meines Volkes. Gib du jetzt deine Stimme ab. Wenn ja, dann tritt für mich ein, so wie ich für dich eingetreten bin.
So again, you can feel the passion, like, vibrating through him, right? This is very important. Nice, Owie. It's very important to understand that that's why Hitler was so successful, because he was not only was he intelligent and a philosopher type who was able to bring these people something that was actually better for themselves, right? Which the men, let's word it like this. If you look at all of Germany, right, there was the men in the SS, there was the men in the Wehrmacht, and then there was simply the regular peoples, the regular civilians of Germany that were following him. And all these videos, you see them all running out, throwing their arms in the air, they're smiling, they're crying tears of joy, they're so happy to see him, right, and support him. Now, do you really believe that all of those people in that crowd, every single one of them, do you believe all of them truly understood, like, all of his doctrine, all of his worldview, and how important and well put out it all was? Or do you think they were all following him with emotion, right? Because, he's been president for a bit, my country's a lot better. I'm no longer poor, I'm no longer broken on the streets, right? So they're following the mass, they're following the social stratum. A lot of this is driven by emotion. And all of mass movements work like this. Again, let's look at these people who are white liberals going fighting in the streets on behalf of BLM. Do you think they're logically looking at this, or do you think that they're emotionally following it because they've been manipulated to feel bad for blacks and feel like they need to be stood up for, right? They're not intellectually like, oh man, black people are in a really bad spot here and me standing in the streets is going to really fix that, right? No, they've been indoctrinated to think that blacks are oppressed and there's some kind of lower class that needs to be helped and uplifted, right? Meanwhile, advocating that is, in essence, in the long run, after years in the future, you're advocating your own extinction to come about, right? It's basically a suicide cult. They just don't recognize it as such. It's because they're not driven by reason or logic. They're driven purely by emotion. Let's continue further here with Michael Segrew. Oops, wrong. Welcome, Andy. Nice to see you. Phil, I see you in the Twitter chat as well. Welcome, guys.
This is the realm of the forms. So this logical doctrine is tied in with his earlier books 2, 3, 4, and 5. He constructs the ideal city, and then it breaks our heart. We can't have the ideal city. But he doesn't want us to say, well, the ideal city was a waste of time. Exactly the opposite. The world of the senses is somehow fundamentally flawed, and that's what he's gesturing at here. It's not the fault of the theory. It's the fault of this world of rust and corruption. Things don't quite work here. This realm of unsquare squares, uncircular circles. What kind of world is this? Right? Not one that Plato's happy with. All right, now, as a way of making this visible, as a way of appealing, right, moving from logic, here, you know, in the divided line, I was telling you what the logical properties of this are. But in order to make this clearer to you, or if not clearer, make this more vibrant, more living towards you, more vivid, he offers us the myth of the cave. He says, think about this. I think he's talking to Glaucon at this point. He says, imagine people stuck in the bottom of a cave. There's an opening to the cave up in the front, and everyone that's in the cave has their head and shoulders chained so they can only look at a wall. And behind them there's a large fire, and men carry things between the fire and the wall so the people can't see them carrying these objects. And they look at the shadows cast by the fire and these objects on that wall and say, those shadows are reality. In other words, they are fundamentally mistaken in their ontological views. He thinks this is the whole pre- and non-philosophic group of all the world's people. In other words, everyone that doesn't understand the Platonic theory of forms is living in the realm of shadows because they believe in images and sense perceptions. They believe that these things are real. In fact, Plato says, until we learn philosophy, we are living in the realm of the senses, in the realm of space and time, in the realm of unreality. Now, the philosopher manages to liberate himself.
I just want to pick that up again. There's a really, really strong statement, okay, and it's something to understand for what we're discussing here, is until you understand philosophy, until all of us educate ourselves on philosophy, we are living in that false realm. This is fact, actually. This is definition, right? This goes right back to what I was saying earlier here. We have this line here in between the two. Here is belief and opinion. Here is truth and knowledge, right? And all of modern society, no one's taught them truth and knowledge, right? You've gotten objective knowledge, like math and things like this, but no one's taught you truth and knowledge of how to live, how to behave, how to be a real man. You don't get that in society. Isn't going to teach you that. You have to look on the very outskirts, the echo chambers, on the edges of society, on the fringes of society, as they call it. That's where you have to look to get this kind of information. How shameful is that? So because of that, most people are living in that world of belief and opinion. So again, philosophy is the way to pull them out of that, pull them up into truth and knowledge. I'll continue here, but I just want to hammer home that point. Listen very closely what he's going to say here. Question mark. Welcome, brother. Welcome.
In fact, Plato says, until we learn philosophy, we are living in the realm of the senses, in the realm of space and time, in the realm of unreality. Now, the philosopher manages to liberate himself by means of dialectic and makes the slow and arduous journey up to the realm of the sun. Now, the people that get up to the realm of the sun, that make this arduous journey, see true reality, which would be analogous to the realm of the forms. And the sun is the form of the good. And you can't directly apprehend the sun, but the sun makes everything else in the world visible and possible. In some ways, it generates being. It generates knowability. It is the one unique, perfect, universal object which somehow generates the reality of everything else. So the form of the good, which is what the philosopher king finds out about, is like the sun. Now, my view is that the reason why he doesn't go anywhere beyond the simile here is that the form of the good is fundamentally inexpressible. It's like talking about the fundamental nature or essence of God. It comes very close to that. In other words, if you can imagine God devoid of personality, the form of the good, which generates reality and being and allows the world to exist, has many qualities of the earlier sun god myths, but all the personality has been drained away from it. And now it's just a pure logical construct, which somehow generates the thusness of things.
Again, this is really important, this allegory of the cave. So Aoi says, I don't think most people who hear the allegory of the cave know it with the metaphor of shadows for false knowledge. Yes, so there's, I'm going to push another philosopher into this point here. But if you look into Guido von List, he was the man who created Ariosophy and talks about the Aryan peoples. Our race should be our religion. He's the guy who thought this up. But when he analyzes the Aryan peoples and their history, he talks about a concept that he calls the tripartite. Okay, and that tripartite, what he explains that as, is there's always a triple meaning behind things that we do, okay? It's a cultural thing that we do. We have triple meanings, okay? So for Plato or for Socrates, whoever you want to attribute the allegory of the cave to, there is a triple meaning here, okay? The first meaning is to describe exactly this table of the forms of belief, of knowledge, and then of true knowledge all the way up at the top. And then underneath, obviously, is representations. So the shadows on the wall are the representations. The men that are chained to that wall who view that as reality, they are the belief, right? Then the philosopher who breaks out and starts working out of the cave into the light is the knowledge, okay? And then that true light, the true real thing that he gets out when he goes out there and sees the sun, the real light, like this natural source of light, that is the truest essence of knowledge, okay? Beyond the world, it's its own essence, okay? That's symbolic of this. He's creating the symbology between his explanation of these four things and the allegory of the cave. Additionally, the allegory of the cave is also meant to symbolize the falsity of man, right? And it tells a third story. This is a really important story as well. is that when that philosopher comes back down, when he goes back down into that cave in the story and tries to tell the people that are chained to the wall, guys, I just went out there. I experienced true knowledge in its real essence. Please come, let me show you. It's amazing. They fear him. They're terrified of him. They get angry with him. This shows you that cognitive dissonance, right? It's additionally symbolic of how people react when you try to bring them the truth today. Go to your neighbor, knock on your neighbor's door, and try to tell them that the Holocaust is bullshit. Good luck. Seriously, good luck. You watch the reaction you're going to get. If you don't do it correctly, watch the reaction you're going to get. And that's why Plato advocates, or Socrates, whoever you want to attribute this to, advocates for dialectic rather than just throwing it at people. So if you go knock on your neighbor's door and say, oh, hey, buddy, did you know that the Holocaust is fucking bullshit? That didn't happen. They're going to go, boom, slam the door in your face. Oh, God, that guy's crazy Nazi. Now, go knock on the door and sit down, talk with him first, build a relationship. How are you? You know, it's nice to see you. I brought you a dinner, right? Then you sit down and you say, what do you think about the Holocaust? You're not telling them anything. You're not speaking. You're asking them a question. What do you think about the Holocaust? And when they go, oh, I think it was a horrible thing, you say, why? And then when they say, oh, well, because a lot of people died. Then you say, how? They say, well, they got gassed. Say, where did you hear that? Oh, well, I heard that on Schindler's List. Well, isn't that a fiction movie? Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, it's a fiction movie. So does that mean that the gas chambers were really real, or did you hear it somewhere else as well? Huh, come to think of it, no, that is only where I heard it. So, huh, now you've broken through the cognitive dissonance because you've never turned it on. You forced them to turn it on themselves. You understand how dialectic works? Meanwhile, if you were to just come and tell the guy gas chambers didn't exist, he's going to go, no, what are you talking about? What? No, it's too much at once. You're taking his plate and you're putting a 5-course meal on the plate and going, eat this shit, dude. Right? When some people, well, I want to start with my appetizer, and then I want to just have a couple fries, and okay, now I want to start cutting my steak real slow. I don't want to swallow the whole thing. But you have to slowly work them towards this, and through dialectic, you force them to do it themselves consciously. They are the ones making those conscious thoughts and actions. Therefore, they are the ones coming to the conclusion. If you give them the conclusion without them coming to it on their own, they will not agree with you. That makes sense. Dialectic is very important. It's very important to understand dialectic, especially with the circumstance that we are in. We, as the people who understand what actually happened in World War II, as the people who actually understand who is destroying our nation in real time and extincting our people, knowing all of these things, we are the philosophers of today. It is our duty to bring that simple mass, all of these concepts, and this cannot be done by shoving it down their throats. It doesn't work like that, right? As adequately explained here in the allegory of the cave. Question mark awareness says, people always ask, what is Aryan? I actually have a clip on my Twitter explaining it, but I'll explain it one more time. Aryan by definition means noble. Okay. It by definition means noble. Very well said. This guy says, blurring Hollywood with reality, you got America. Yeah, absolutely. This is the problem. Most people's worldviews are literally wrapped into what movies they've seen, what they've seen on the television, what they see around them. Think about how many people reference movies, reference TV shows. I refuse to watch it. I refuse to even look into these things. And when people reference them, I refuse to talk with them about it, because what you're doing is you're taking what Plato would describe as the representation, which is the lowest form of reality, the literal lowest form, right? Movies are just like poetry and paintings. They're representations of reality, okay? So they're not true. They're tampered by man's opinion, okay? They're even underneath man's opinion because they're just a representation of such things. You're taking those and referencing them as if they are knowledge. So you're taking category, the final category, category 4, and you're mixing it with category 2 and trying to conflate them as the same. It's insanity. It's quite literally insanity. So anybody who tries to reference movies as a form of knowledge or as giving you some kind of educational advice or something that is higher than what you're talking about at the moment, do not discuss that. Do not discuss that. Don't play into that game. Midwestern Warrior says, not all whites are Aryans. Correct. And also, not all Aryans are white. It's not just about skin color. However, it is the one of the largest factors, which is why we describe it as such. Southern Europeans are a good example. Portuguese, right? A little bit darker in skin tone. They're not fully white. You could easily mistake them for a Beaner if you didn't know any better. And they are, by definition, they would be Aryans. They would be considered as such. We talked about this before as well. Aristocracy. Aristocracy. By definition, the word aristocracy means Aryan rule. Okay, so it comes from the Greek term aristos, which means noble or Aryan, and it comes from kratos, meaning power, rule. Okay, so aristocracy, aristocrat. Okay, it's Aryan rule. Yeah, I agree, Urban. It does. It certainly goes way deeper. It was just an example to give on its face of how dialectic can work. Because many people don't know that they've been indoctrinated through the schooling system about the Holocaust. Actually, a lot of them, probably in their American public schools, watched Schindler's List as a version of indoctrination.
Well, that's what the form of the good is, and the way in which we get to that is through dialectic, because that brings us to the knowledge of the forms, and we gradually climb up further and further towards the final form, but our journey of dialectic, and this is very important because Plato emphasizes in Book 6 the journey aspect of this, the journey motif, the journey of dialectic comes up again and again and again. And the point here is that the journey is asymptotic. We might actually be able to find out, get a tiny glimpse of the sun itself, but the difficulty is that language won't contain it. So at the end of the journey, Glaucon asks, all right, tell me about the form of the good. What's going on? What is the form of the good? And he says, Glaucon, I'd take you there if I could, son, but I can't. I mean, I've been up there. I've climbed the mountain, but you got to climb the last stage. You got to take yourself. Apparently, one goes beyond dialectic to I know not what. Maybe we don't ultimately get there. Maybe it's just an asymptotic move. But the idea is that human perfection, human virtue, human goodness is tied up with knowledge, because and particularly knowledge of the form of the good. That's what's crucial. So the myth of the cave and the divided line are overlaps. One is a purely logical doctrine, an ontological and epistemological doctrine, which is instantiated in this myth of the cave and made political. So now what the philosopher has to do is come back down from the realm of reality to the realm of shadows, and of course he can't see his way around. I mean, it's a beautiful image and a perfect metaphor. I mean, what an inspired day when Plato thought this up. So he comes back down to the realm of the dark, and people laugh at him because he can't find his way around.
It's a beautiful way to be not indoctrinated, Seven. That's very interesting. Should back this up just a tiny bit.
Logical doctrine and ontological and epistemological doctrine, which is instantiated in this myth of the cave and made political. So now what the philosopher has to do is come back down from the realm of reality to the realm of shadows, and of course he can't see his way around. I mean, it's a beautiful image and a perfect metaphor. I mean, what an inspired day when Plato thought this up. So he comes back down to the realm of the dark, and people laugh at him because he can't find his way around. But of course, he's the only man that understands ultimate reality. This is the high point of the dialogue itself. In other words, when we walk up to the form of the good, when we get out of the cave, this is the high point of this dialogue. It's also the high point of Platonism. Right?
And again, I also want to express to you, because we've discussed both Nietzsche and Socrates, or Plato, in this discussion. If you're already familiar with this work by Socrates or Plato, however you want to word it, if you're already familiar with this work and you know the concept of the allegory of the cave and the philosopher coming back down into the cave and bringing knowledge to the people, I highly suggest that you read Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Nietzsche. He goes into this exact same concept. Zarathustra is a man, a philosopher, right? But he is, in Zarathustra's wording, he is a superman, right? Again, the ubermensch. He's above even the philosophers. He's beyond all of that, okay? In the field of morality. So he very much is a similarity to Socrates preaching of the philosopher king. And when he comes down, Zarathustra in this book lives up in the mountains, and he comes down to the people to express these ideals to the people and open their minds to these things. And in this book, he gets the same reaction that Socrates' philosopher gets when going back into the cave and trying to talk to the men in the cave. He's laughed at and ridiculed and shamed for trying to bring these people something that is better for them.
This is Plato's theology, you might say, right? The form of the good and the ideas themselves. Not only is Plato trying to revamp and refurbish all of Greek literature, but he's also trying to revamp and refurbish all of Greek religion. And he's invented a new religion. It's going to be transparently worship of the forms, and then we'll give them a personality. We'll say the form of bravery is a real brave guy that wears armor and stuff like that. He'll be like the old Ares, except that he won't have any of Ares' bad qualities. Why? Because he's a form. So in other words, what he's trying to do is supplant Homeric religion with a new Platonic religion, form worship. They're perfect. They don't really have personality, but we could probably think up a myth for you if you really need one. That is the key thing that the philosopher king is going to have to be led towards the realm of the forms. That's why his study is going to be dialectical from the years 30 to 35. In other words, until he's 20, he's going to get the same gymnastic and music education as the regular guardians. Then from 20 to 30, the education of the guardian will involve war, but also mathematics, because mathematics is our bridge up into the realm of the forms. So he's going to have to learn a lot of geometry. He'll be able to prove all kinds of great stuff. Anybody, incidentally, in the Platonic Dialogues that has spent their time studying math or is caught studying mathematics, like Theaetetus, always a good interlocutor, always smart. It's always a sign that he's gotten a good education. If you're studying with the sophist, bad education, doesn't know any math. I mean, it always tips you off. So find out who taught someone. You'll always find out if his argument is any good before you even read it. Well, after some exposure to dialectic from 30 to 35, then the philosopher king in training will go down and help conduct practical politics until he's 50 years old. Thereafter, if one has gotten the appropriate training and shown worthy of this philosophical education, you might be able to become a philosopher king after the age of 50. So it's only for the old. And also, I believe that the implications of Platonic feminism are that there will be philosopher queens too. In other words, I can't see how the body is going to make much difference. If they show that they're wise, courageous, moderate, and just, I don't think that sex is going to have very much to do with this. This is about souls and minds. This is not about bodies. So the key thing for the philosopher king is that after 50, having gone through this enormous progress of dialectic and mathematics and all this education, he or she will have seen the form of the good, and having seen the form of the good, will be able to make decisions for the city and make sure that everyone is doing the right thing. But you need that knowledge of the form of the good. Elsewise, you are only legislating in your own interest or in whatever strikes your fancy. And that's going to lead to all kinds of complications, and that's going to lead to all sorts of degeneracy, and that's going to lead to all sorts of injustice. And injustice will, of course, cause the city to factionalize, and you'll get an internally incoherent city and an externally evil city. All right. Remember that you want to keep a unified soul and a unified city. And you want a harmonious soul between its various parts and a harmonious city between its various parts. The only way to do that is to subordinate all of them to knowledge, to this new Platonic hero of knowledge, the philosopher king, or in this case, instantiated as Socrates. Now, having come up to that point, we're now going to gradually be led down away from the realm of the forms. And what's going to be picked up next after the education of the philosopher king in Book 8 is the degenerate regimes. For each of the bad souls, and there are five kinds of souls, and four of them are bad, there's going to be four kinds of regime, and four of them will be bad, and one will be connected to the other. Those of you who know Nietzsche's book, The Genealogy of Morals, will find in Book 8 a genealogy of morals. Nietzsche was full of envy of Plato, because he was the great educator of the West and wanted to supplant him. So many of Nietzsche's ideas that look real kind of new and kind of original are not new or original at all. Nietzsche was a philologist. So in Book 8 of the Republic, we get the first of the great genealogies of morals. And he explains how, if we were to ever have a philosopher king and a good city, how it would inevitably degenerate, because this world of space and time is a mess. It doesn't work right. What would happen? Well, we would neglect education, because education is the guardian of the guardians, right? Education is what makes sure that the guardians behave properly. If they're not educated properly, the result is going to be that they're going to start to love honor rather than love knowledge. And that means that eventually the city will move into the first of its injustices, praising and valuing honor over knowledge. And then you're going to get something like the Spartan or the Cretan constitutions, where honor, it's called the Timocratic constitution, where the man of honor supplants the man of knowledge and says knowledge is virtue and honor is sometimes not virtuous. If you think about Achilles, if you think about Odysseus or Agamemnon, honorable men are not always good men and often not knowledgeable men.
So again, you heard he was referring exactly to Nietzsche using some of these concepts, almost robbing these concepts, so to speak, from Plato's works. Also, additionally, he describes these types of souls, and he equates the type of soul to the type of civilization. So he calls them characters, right? So he'll lay out the different types of society that are degenerative or corrupt, such as democracy, for example, oligarchy, for example. And then he goes on, after laying out the actual civilization type, he lays out the soul of the man that advocates for that. So the democratic soul, the oligarchic soul. He starts to lay out the actual personality that falls into this. And if you have not yet read The Republic, I'm going to highly recommend, even if not, if you're not interested in reading the whole book, you at least read that piece. At least read specifically where he discusses democracy and the democratic character. It is unbelievable how 2,200 years ago he can write a work that is still true of democracy and the people living amongst a democracy today. Nothing has changed. Midwestern Warrior, this is Michael Segrue speaking.
So the first of the degenerate regimes will be the timocratic regime, the regime of honor. That will break up because these honorable men do not know how to control their emotions. They do not know how to control their desires. And the necessary consequence of that will be an oligarchy, where a few men try and accumulate a great many pleasures. They'll get to control a lot of property, and they'll control a great many things that they would want. And they will work to satisfy the necessary pleasures. They will have some sort of self-discipline, but it will be a clear deterioration from the regime of the timocratic man. The next degenerate regime after the oligarch, his son, will be the democrat. He will want he will want to pursue the unnecessary as opposed to the necessary desires. And that's true of the demos. That's true of most people. So the next stage down in our descent away from the good regime is towards democracy. So it goes from the ideal city to the timocratic city to the oligarchic city to the democratic city. And then just below the democratic city, which is full of all kinds of pleasures and pains and miscellaneous emotions and a very unorderly, disorderly, un-Apollonian soul, we get the worst of regimes, the tyrannical regime, and the worst of men, the tyrannical man. And the tyrannical man is the one that wants to have as many desires as he can and to satisfy them as completely as he can, but this is a wretched life where your desires always outstrip your capacity to satisfy them. So you're constantly scratching itches, but you have many more itches than you can scratch. So you're constantly in a wretched state, being pushed around by your feelings, never being able to organize your soul. And each of these four degenerate regimes corresponds to a phase of moral corruption. And because the city is like the man, right, is a main idea of the Republic, it is important to note two things. One, that our interlocutors in this book have been these kinds of men. This is often overlooked. It is clear enough that Socrates represents the philosopher king, the good man, the man of wisdom, however you want to put that. Even leaving the irony in, there's no doubt that he's the morally best, most intelligent man in the dialogue. Number two, the timocratic man, Glaucon, is most brave in all things. Glaucon rushes in. Glaucon is interested in war. Glaucon is interested in sex. Glaucon has a really silver soul. He has many of the Homeric virtues, but also some of the Homeric vices. And Glaucon represents that next step down from Socrates. That's why he's most closely associated with Socrates in the dialogue. The timocratic man has the greatest affinity to the philosopher. Why are they together at the very beginning? Because they have the most in common. And Socrates thinks that maybe I could make a philosopher out of this guy if I just bumped him another step up. His brother, Adeimantus, beginning of book four, Adeimantus says, you know what, Socrates, I don't see how your rulers can be happy, since after all, they don't get to have a lot of property and big houses and nice things like that.
Honky, I'll give you guys the link in the chat right now to this video. I'm very happy that people take interest in watching it for themselves. It's good. A lot of these videos are very hard to just watch one time and kind of fully grasp everything. It's good to analyze them a few times. So let me link you guys this right now. I'll link it in all three chats. We'll put it in the Odyssey, the Twitter, and the GTV chat. Sorry for those who are on Speak Free Radio. If you guys are interested in watching, just go ahead and hop on one of those chat rooms and click on the link. White Escoy, you know, welcome, brother, welcome.
Glaucon is the oligarchic man who's interested in accumulating property. I mean, remember, he comes from Plato's family, Plato's brother, and they're a high-ranking family within Athens. I mean, they're an influential family. So Glaucon represents, at least initially, the oligarchic man. Now, in that beginning in Book 1, when Polemarchus sends his slave to pull Socrates and say, look, stay here, Socrates. I mean, I'm going to hold on until Polemarchus gets here. And then they talk and say, look, there are a lot more of us than there are of you. This is about power and knowledge. Can you stay if we? Can you leave if we won't listen to your persuasion? No. Well, then we'll have a vote, and we'll all vote that you will come with us. Polemarchus is the democratic man, and that's why they have that vote. Nothing happens by accident in a Platonic dialogue. If somebody votes, it tells you something about them. If he loses something, whatever he's lost is symbolic of something. If he has to go somewhere and do something, whatever he's going to do, that's symbolic of something. Everything is symbolic. So when they have that little vote in the beginning, that's tremendously important because it tells you what kind of souls we're dealing with. We're in a democratic city, and Polemarchus, the guy who initiates this, is the democratic man. And it's not hard to figure out who the tyrannical man is. It's Thrasymachus, right, who says, justice is the advantage of the stronger. Let's take control of the city and indulge ourselves. Now, here's what's really important. Not only do we get this decline in the degenerate regimes in Book 8, but Socrates also gives us the key for moving back up the ladder. In other words, if you can climb down, you can climb up. The way you do it is by censoring the poets and by educating people, by giving them access to good, morally uplifting poetry. Like, for example...
So, for example, today, right, again, poetry back then was their form of entertainment. It was their Hollywood. So today, you want to fix the people, you want to bring them back up the ladder of morality and living correctly again. You got to censor Hollywood. You got to censor all this pornography on the internet. Shut all of that to the side, and then re-educate them with something better. Simple as that. That's exactly how Socrates lays this out: how to bring people back up that moral ladder.
This. In other words, think about what's happened to our interlocutors now in the course of the dialogue. First is the end of Book 5. At the end of Book 5, Glaucon says, you know, Socrates, I made this great praise of injustice at the beginning of Book 2 with the myth of Gyges, but now that you go through the argument and explain it to me, this is really stupid, and I'm really sorry I did this. I can see now that the only good is justice, and that a man's life would be wretched without it. And clearly enough, I'm really sorry for having said these bad things about justice. Injustice is clearly an evil thing. No one that understood what he was doing would do that. What does that mean? Our timocratic man, up we go. He has been uplifted by his interaction with Socrates. He has gotten an education. Not any kind of final knowledge, because he didn't get introduced directly to the form of the good, but he has clearly been morally and intellectually improved by this.
Again, intellectual education through dialectic. Simple as that. Socrates opens a dialectic with the guy, starts questioning him on his own beliefs, his own systems of thought, and by the end of the conversation, the man is now questioning his own beliefs and thought because he has no really logical basis behind it, and he comes to recognize this in due time.
Virtue is knowledge, and when he gets more knowledge, he improves in virtue. Up we go. Now, his brother Adeimantus, who at the beginning of Book 4 is really interested in property. He wants big houses and stuff. The beginning of Book 6, Polemarchus says to him, you know, whispers to him, Socrates hasn't explained the community of women and the abolition of private property. Glaucon, who used to be kind of timid and reserved and moderate and austere, walks out, because he's now the timocratic man. He's moved up a notch from oligarchic to timocratic. He says, Socrates, stand right there. I'm arresting you a second time. He's gotten brave all of a sudden. Why? Up we go. He's gotten ratcheted up from oligarch to timocrat. He says, now you're going to stand and answer our questions. Clearly, the kind of interaction that he has with Socrates, the good education that he gets, morally improves him. Polemarchus. Polemarchus starts out as our democratic man in the beginning. And then he gets all kinds of, well, moderate and restrained and austere. And instead of directly confronting Socrates at that beginning of Book 6, he goes to, beginning of Book 5, he whispers to Adeimantus. He's moved from being the democratic man to being the oligarchic man. Up we go. And what's great about that scene at the beginning of Book 5, Thrasymachus says the only other thing that he says outside of Book 1. He makes two statements. One, he says, I'll go with that. I vote with that. Make it unanimous. We all want you to stand and explain the community of women in the three waves, Socrates. What has happened to Thrasymachus? He has moved from being the tyrannical man. He has been made a social animal, brought into our little political organization, and he votes. So now he's the democratic man. Up we go, up we go, up we go. Everybody gets improved. It's beautiful. And the city is like the man. We got five interlocutors. We got five kinds of city. We're golden here. I mean, the isomorphism between city and man is really beautiful. And this instantiates the thing that it's trying to explain to you, that good education will bring you up and bad education will bring you down. And when I first read this, I didn't know books could do stuff like that. I mean, that's one of the great things in Plato. I mean, if you read this book seriously, you occasionally get this landslide of information and landslide of coherence. And this is an example of that. When I first found this out 20 years ago, it just made my weekend. And this is the kind of thing you ought to be looking for in Plato. Everything is there for a reason. Well, we get these degenerate regimes, and we get the way to satisfy the problems generated by these degenerate regimes. And book 9 looks at the soul of the tyrant. It shows that the tyrant is wretched and miserable, and also takes a crack at Euripides. Socrates and Plato obviously hate Euripides, and who can blame them? I mean, those of you who know Euripides, I don't much care for these tragedies. And he goes after Euripides saying, look, he's a praiser of tyrants, which he is, and says that we don't need that kind of art in our good society. It makes tyrannical men even worse. It gives them the bad education that I've just shown you how to reverse. And then book 10 is very important. He goes back to a recapitulation of his critique of the poets. Why? Because he shows that poetry is educational, and these dialogues are intended to be educational. And education can either teach you the truth or not. And if it doesn't teach you the truth, it makes you worse rather than better. And this is the source of all our political and moral evils, because all knowledge is virtue, and all ignorance is vice. So all our vices are really ignorance. What does that mean? That means that we're really going to have to double back and censor Homer, because when Homer speaks well, we'll bring him in, but when he doesn't speak well, out he goes. He tries to make our young men into Achilles, and they get wrathful and petulant and want to kill something. They want to become tyrants. That's no good. So he criticizes epic, and he criticizes imitators in general.
So again, one thing you have to think about with this, comparing modern society to what they experienced all the way back then, I'm going to make this point, and I think we'll close it up after this. I'll throw some music on afterwards, and we'll do the outro. We're actually already at that two-hour mark. Today's show went quite fast. It felt like it really zoomed by. But to compare this modern society to what he's expressing all the way back then, you know, you could get these moral subversions, these things that were dragging you away, making you the lower man. You could get all of that simply just from reading, right? Just from one book. The one book that everybody admired at the time was the Odyssey, right? And the Iliad. Those are the two books that people were greatly following, both by Homer, and they were both forms of poetry. And he would idolize certain behaviors in this poetry, certain behaviors that would be considered degenerative or would be bad influences on the children, on the youth of the society, right? So this is just one example. It's just a book. That's it, right? That was like their go-to book. And this is what Socrates attributed to degenerating all of the youth just off of reading something that was giving them bad ideas in this book, okay? Now, imagine, Gazing, I'm live on Twitter, my friend. At least on my end, we've got 212 people in here on Twitter. A dead chat room, but we got a lot of viewers. Now, compare this to today, compare it to what we're experiencing now, and it's shocking, right? We don't just have a book that's educating our youth in a foul direction. We have movies, we have social media, we have the internet, we've got television, all of these different TV shows and streaming services, things like that. We've got video games, we've got books themselves. Right, our educational system, all of these things are educating these people into that lower realm. All of those things. It's not just one. Right, back then it was just one book doing this. Now it's all of these things collapsing in on people. So again, it's very hard to blame the people that are misdirected or misguided in society today, because there are so many things misdirecting them. It's absurd to even think about the amount of things. Michael, what does Michael describe himself as? Unfortunately, for those who are not familiar with Michael Segrue, He passed away about 2 or 3 months ago. I was trying very hard to get him on my show. I think it was just around the timing when he was getting sick and potentially getting ready to pass away. Michael Sugrue was he would just describe himself simply as a philosopher, a student of philosophy, very much that. I don't think so, Urban, because the viewership in the chat seems to go up at a very normal, like, fluctuative rate. Like, we always start with, like, 30, 40, then it goes to 60, works to 80, works to... So, I don't think the viewership is false. I don't know. The chat is just very slow on Twitter compared to everywhere else, so... Let's test it. One in the chat if you guys are on Twitter. Two if you are not visible in the chat room on Twitter. I know people have to chat with their actual accounts, too, so that could be a factor. I don't know. I'm not sure. One if you guys are here on Twitter. Two if you are not. Seems very, very dry on the Twitter chat. Anyways, folks, we're coming up on the last 5 minutes here. So we're going to outro the show, and then we're going to throw you guys some outro music in order for you guys to just relax and enjoy the rest of the show before having a good evening. I can't either. I cannot either, Urban. I'm not sure. Obviously, if you guys are on Speak Free Radio, you guys want to get connected with all my other platforms. We're on Odyssey, we're on GTV, and we're on Twitter, at Logos Revealed on all of them. There's just an I at the end on Twitter. Make sure you guys do follow me on Twitter. I've been growing on there, trying to join spaces in there. Yo, I see you on Twitter. There we go. Awesome. Nice to see you. Nice to see there's some people in here. Struggle for Hooks. All right, see, we got people. Just a little more shy in the chatting regard. Please, if you guys are in Twitter and you guys are watching, feel free to chat, to contribute, throw some thoughts in, some questions. It definitely adds to the quality of the show. Certainly does. Awesome, Gazing. Awesome. Nice. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Yeah, if you guys are on any of these platforms, if you want to reach out
great
to me
stream,
personally
as
and
always.
Have thoughts or questions, you can message me on Twitter. You can message me on Gab. You could also message me on Telegram. I'm at Logos Revealed on Telegram, as well as send me an email. I know some people are more old school. They like doing emails. It's just at logosrevealed88@gmail.com if you guys want to do that. Ozark Waffen with a very generous $15 investment. Guys, can we get the Romans in the chat for Ozark Waffen? Thank you, my friend. I greatly appreciate that. Don't forget, if you guys do want to support the stream, as Ozark just has, all of the links are in the description of both GTV and Odyssey for you guys to help support the stream, keep it going. We've got all kinds of different projects going on right now. A lot of new things coming very soon. We've got the website in the works. We've got Logos Academy series in the works. I'm doing a lot of writing. We've got book club going on. We've got interviews coming up. All kinds of things. Lots of stuff to watch. Lots of productive, valuable things that are certainly worth your time. We got a no-nonsense show over here. So if you guys do want to support that and keep that rolling, all the links are in the description to do so. And it is absolutely greatly appreciated. All right, guys, I think that's going to close it for tonight. Thank you guys all again so much for watching. I'll see you guys tomorrow. We'll be live at 7 p.m. Eastern, and we're going to be joined with Paul Allen. Paul Allen is one of the Groiper crew. We're going to be discussing with him ideals, dogma, worldview a little bit. It'll start more of like an interview. I'm going to ask about him like I always do on my show and give a little bit of background as to who he is, and then we'll go into some discussion and try to break down those unfortunate just disagreements that we have between these two movements and the fights that we have, which I think are primarily due to miscommunication. Phil, I see you in here as well, brother, from Twitter. Thank you, my friend. Alrighty, guys, thank you again so much for watching. I'm going to throw you guys the music now, and the stream will be ending at 7:02 precisely. So thank you, folks. I will see you guys tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern. Have a wonderful night.